Good afternoon, Dr. Daniel J. Guerra, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is 10 February 2024. We are going to be launching lecture number four on this first biochemical mosaic, where one of the leading players in this mosaic is going to be the phosphatidic acid phosphatase. But we've introduced a number of polypeptides, and we've also talked a little bit about some of the lipids involved. So as we go through this lecture today, and then the subsequent two or three after this, it's going to be important for you to keep all, register all of the different polypeptides and the different lipid modifying means of altering mitochondrial membrane lipid composition and sequence in your mind. And I'm going to reiterate and keep you going with a synthesis every other time I need to, because I want to make sure that you're keeping track of what's going on. It's a very cool thing we're discussing here from this Nature paper of 2019. But remember, I'm bringing in a great deal of other literature so that you see the context of what's going on in this protease-mediated alteration of inner membrane of the mitochondria during a stress response associated often with cancers. Okay, so there's your clinical association, but that last part's not necessary to know. What is more important is that you have a protease that exists in the inner mitochondrial membrane that controls a GTPase dynamin protein, OPA1, at the level of it being a substrate for proteolysis, that can convert OPA1 into different, still useful active forms, but finally can also degrade the protein and several other proteins that are linked not just to the dynamism, pun intended, of mitochondrial fission and fusion, but also linked simply to phospholipid lipid metabolism endomembranously in the mitochondria. Okay? So those are the two important things that just should have in mind before we get started. Now, here we go. Okay. Remember that mitochondria are self-replicating and autonomous in the cell. So when the cell needs more oxidative metabolism, particularly oxidative phosphorylation, and everything that's component of the mitochondria to support that, beta oxidation, as well as utilization of amino acids after transaminations into the tricarboxylic acid pathway, all of that can be elevated by increasing the number of mitochondria in the cell. Also understand that during that fission process where you're getting a replication of the mitochondria, there can be a halting of it, which is a pathological event, which can generate mitochondria insipidly taking in part of other organelles and basically then functioning as an autophagolysosome, no longer as a mitochondrion. And that's because of the proteolysis that occurred to the membrane proteins that are in the intact normally functioning mitochondria, even those proteins that help regulate the fission-fusion process for replication, mitophagy, or for complete ablation of the mitochondria, such as in cellular autophagy, and or finally apoptosis. Okay. So when you have a dysfunctional or damaged mitochondria, that's going to induce to the cell a serious, often mortal blow. And that mortal blow is going to go directly to programmed cell death, because mitochondria cannot be lost and the cell is still maintained in just about every cell lineage there is. Okay? There are a few cells that can lose their mitochondria, such as aging red blood cells, which can still carry out some functions, because red blood cells at that point are just carrying molecular oxygen, you know, HbO2. But all other cells, in order to be functional, have to have functional mitochondria, and of course, peroxisomes, endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi apparatus, and indeed the nucleus. Now, erythrocytes, or that is red blood cells, can also lose the nucleus because they no longer need any gene expression. All they're doing is carrying HbO2. Okay. But they still, red blood cells still have some mitochondria. They're not completely removed by mitophagy. So, but that means essentially all cells have to have mitochondria. Just so you understand, I assume you did, but you know, sometimes you have to be careful about what you can assume, because I'm not getting feedback. You're not in the classroom asking questions, right? And you can ask questions. You can go directly to the website for Authentic Biochemistry and you can ask questions and I'll respond to them. Or you can go to authenticbiochemistry@gmail.com, which is our official email. And you can ask me questions and I will answer them online. Okay. All right. Now, let's get into this. When you supplement these cells that are going to have knockout of the protease YME1L, when you supplement with glutamine, you can stimulate the growth of those cells when they have the intact protease, but not when that protease has been knocked out. So it means that proteolysis, because that's what the YME1L does, is necessary for anaplerosis, which means bringing carbon in the back door. I mean, it's a way of putting it, but allowing glutamine to go to glutamate to go to alpha-ketoglutarate, and therefore enter into the TCA. You see? Now, that means that deamination and transamination are required. Okay? And you lose those activities in the mitochondria that are deficient in the protease. Glutamine-dependent respiration is higher in wild type, obviously, than in the YME1L knockouts. But deletion of that protease had no effect on overall mitochondrial bioenergetics. Of course, that makes sense because that bioenergetic component is going to be driven by glucose or fatty acids. You see? Now, of course, glutamine can serve as an alternative source of carbon via deamination followed by transamination to the TCA. And that will actually maintain citrate levels, which is of particular importance for cells that are forced to grow as spheroids in culture, which is how these are growing, which means anchorage independent, which is how tumors grow. Remember, this is like a mimetic for or stand-in for tumor cells, okay, growing unattached. That's an important component of this detailed work, all right? Now, there was a reduced level of isocitrate and aconitate in the knockout protease cells. So this means the immediate pre-dehydrogenase sector of the TCA. Okay? So that's interesting, right? Those two proteins are going to be, that means the isocitrate dehydrogenase and maybe the aconitase are going to be corrupted because of a lack of the protease. But the other TCA cycle, enzymes and intermediates, remain largely unaffected. Okay? And indeed, the glutamine-derived metabolites like glutamate and even aspartate are diminished when you don't have the protease. So you can see that the protease is functioning to maintain the anaplerosis component of the TCA. Now, all this means that there's a requirement for the YME1L protease to be efficient for glutamine utilization. And it suggests there is an insufficient filling in or replenishment of the TCA when that protease is no longer available, when it's knocked out. Okay, and it's all in spheroid culture. Now, I take you deeper into this. Now, we're going to go into another paper so I can explain to you more about the mitochondria. Decreased mitochondrial membrane potentials. Now, here we're going to be talking about in the cerebrospinal fluid, have been detected in patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage compared to delayed cerebral ischemia. So you find decreased mitochondrial membrane potentials in the CSF of SAS patients, that's subarachnoid hemorrhaging, accompanied by delayed cerebral ischemia. However, whether or not these are like abnormal mechanisms of the mitochondria that are associated with the development of delayed cerebral ischemia has to be fully examined. So under cerebral ischemia, what happens? Mitochondria actually move to, that's what we're finding in the CSF, the extracellular space. So mitochondria can leave the cell. They can go through fission, fusion, and they can be completely removed by phagy, but also they can leave the cell. That's I'm counting four different potential fates for mitochondria. Okay. Now, when they leave a cell, that means those cells, what did I just tell you about the necessary component of mitochondria? You're going to have an issue with neurological function of those neurons, right? When the mitochondria leaves. So the question you could ask is, are autophagy and or mitophagy in these CSF, this is central, cerebrospinal fluid, if that is sufficient to provide an insight into understanding delayed cerebral ischemia? So they took CSF samples, this is a 2021 paper, and they collected them from over 50 SAS patients. That's the subarachnoid hemorrhage patients, and about 21 of those were DCI, and the other non-DCI were 35 of that population. Okay, they looked at CSF cells using autophagy and mitophagy markers. What are those markers? We already mentioned some of them. I'll just mention just one of them, ULK1. And they were using RT-PCR and, of course, Western blots with polypeptides. Now, confocal microscopy with immunogold staining were used to examine differential expression of all those markers in association with the potential for dysfunctional mitochondria. And what they found was there was a significant induction of autophagy with the accumulation of autophagic vacuoles, increased expression of those proteins that are involved in degradation during TCI. Now, those autophagic vacuoles are what I was talking about before, right? Those structures of mitochondria that become more like autophagosomes. So compared to the non-DCI patient, more severe there, remember that's the delayed cerebral ischemia, compared to the non-DCIs, the DCIs had increased transcription, about a twofold increase, according to RT-PCR, of all the proteins that are involved in autophagy and mitophagy. Okay, so that's a linear accounting. So what it suggests is that the DCI is more severe relative to the autophagy or mitophagy of the mitochondria. And so dysfunctional mitochondria play an important role in delayed cerebral ischemia. So I'm adding that so you understand more about what kind of pathologies we may be talking about. Okay. We talk about that we're mostly talking about cancer cells, which are not degrading, which are not dying, right? But when you have an ischemic event, and that's like a long-term hypoxia, those cells are going to die. And they're dying relative to the decrease in functional mitochondria. That's why I gave you that paper to think about. Now, what about glutamine? Glutamine obviously is important in many activities. It's, of course, the carbon source can be used directly for the TCA. But also, glutamine is necessary, and we talked about this, nucleotide metabolism, glutathione production, and in fact, glutamine is used in the synthesis of many of the non-essential, that means constitutively expressed, or that is produced amino acids. So when you get glutamine deprivation, in general, what will happen in cells and culture, you'll get a suppression of cancer growth, and even you'll start to get cancer cell apoptosis. So that's an interesting idea, right? If you can limit glutamine uptake or utilization in tumors, and you know that's going to relate to the overall the ability for the mitochondria to function correctly and apoplotically, you know, regardless of what other kind of biofuel may be used, could be a possible target in ablating tumors. Now, glutaminase 1 is the enzyme which, of course, catalyzed the deamidation of glutamine, right? And that's only one enzyme that's used in glutamine metabolism. We're going to go through several here in a moment. So one of the other things besides glutaminase is the expression of proteins that act as transporters for amino acids across the plasma membrane and across the outer mitochondrial membrane. Now, these are SLC proteins, and particularly the SLC1A is a plasma membrane glutamine transporter. Okay. And so that's going to play a role in overall ability to utilize extracellular glutamine for glutaminolysis. And we're also talk about cytosolic glutamine utilization, right? So this is an important component for us to keep in mind. So glutamine enters the plasma membrane through one of three different of these transporter SLCs. Once it gets into the cytoplasm, glutamine can be used for synthesis of UDP glucagon, for the synthesis of asparagine, the synthesis of precursors to purine biosynthesis, and for the synthesis of carbamoyl phosphate for pyrimidine biosynthesis. The glutamine makes it in the mitochondria, requires another transporter. That again is going to be the SLC1A5 variant for the outer mitochondrial membrane. There, of course, glutamine can be deaminated to glutamate. The glutamate can move back out of the mitochondria through another transporter, an SLC25A, or it can be metabolized to alpha-ketoglutarate via at least two different pathways: glutamate dehydrogenase or glutamate oxaloacetic acid transaminase. Either way, you're going to make alpha-KG, the intermediate TCA. Now, IDH2, isocitrate dehydrogenase isoform 2, there's a mutant form of that, can actually also take alpha-ketoglutarate and make 2-hydroxyglutarate. Now, that we talked about a while back in Authentic Biochemistry, which has another very important function in cellular respiration and in the immune response. So keep that in check and in mind for now. But when the glutamine is finally delivered into the alpha KG system, of course, it'll get converted to succinate, then fumarate, then malate, then oxalacetic acid. Now, if the cell, if the TCA pathway continues on, remember the OAA will condense with acetyl-CoA and make citrate. Right? And of course, the citrate, when conditions are appropriate for it, can leave the mitochondria, and that citrate can be used for production of cytosolic acetyl-CoA for fatty acid synthesis and cholesterologenesis. Okay. Now, the OAA in the TCA pathway can be converted to aspartate via another transaminase, right? And then you'll have the malate aspartate shuttle basically functioning here. And then the aspartate moves through an SLC25A again. And that aspartate can be used for nucleotide synthesis. Okay? Aspartate can also be used for NADPH, oxidative stress production. Now that's working back through the synthesis of malate. All right? Now, finally, alpha-ketoglutarate can leave the mitochondrion. And now here's one more very important thing to keep in mind. Alpha-ketoglutarate can activate mTORC1. That's the anabolic kinase for protein synthesis and anabolism in general for the cell. But a mutated isocitrate dehydrogenase isoform 1, now cytoplasmic, will also generate that unusual product, 2-hydroxyglutarate, which can go in to cause epigenetic modification, resulting in alteration of gene expression, because 2-HG is involved in histone methylation. Okay? So, now you get an idea of how complex glutamine is. So now that now we're moving off the glutamine. That was your glutamine portrait. Okay. Let me check my time here. We're moving back in now to our discussion of the protease. Okay, we're getting back into that paper. So I gave you all that idea. So now you have an understand, not just an idea, I gave you the complete potential use of glutamine in the cell. And you just heard the whole process. So it's involved in many, many metabolic pathways. Yeah. Now, the requirement for the YME1L protease for spheroid formation, remember that's the unattached cells that are grown in culture, that might suggest, even on its own, because a spheroid is allowed now to function unattached, right? That there has to be a great deal of alteration of the proteome. And because this is a protease, what does it tell you? Protease may be acting as a convertase, or it can be selectively removing proteins. It could be enzymes, for example, that would prevent the spheroid unattached tumor-like growth, all right? So we know that this protease will rewire the proteome of the mitochondria via its activity as a protease, so proteolysis, right? And what do they find when they look at the YMEL that's functioning in the spheroid system? They see reduced levels of what would be the substrates for that proteolysis. Three proteins in particular. One is OPA1. Remember, that's the GTP-dependent dynamin protein in the inner mitochondrial membrane necessary for fission fusion. Right? But two other proteins also become depleted because of YME1L protease activity. The prelid-1 and the TIM-17A. So what's prelid-1? Prelid-1 is known as a late embryogenesis abundant protein. It's in a family, of course, localized to the mitochondria, and its alternate splicing results in multiple transcript variants. And it seems to regulate cell death, but also terminal cell differentiation. There's more about that protein we can get to later, but that's just your first flush at it. The other protein that is a substrate for the protease causing the spheroid growth is TIMM, that's TIMM17A. Now, what does that protein do? That protein is really interesting. It is a protein transmembrane transporter. So it's involved in moving protein, importing it into the mitochondrial matrix. So through the inner membrane. Yeah. So TIMM17A is located just the same place that protease is in the mitochondrial IM. Right? It's also interestingly found in the nucleoplasm. Okay. Yes. Now, it seems to be significant for the functioning of all the polypeptides necessary to conduct business in the inner mitochondrial membrane. Okay. And so basically, it is the inner membrane translocase for polypeptides. And that's, again, a substrate for the YME1L protease. Okay. Now, expression of TIMM17A, that translocase, has been observed to be elevated in breast cancer compared with normal tissue. Yes. And overexpression of TIMM17A in breast cancer patients results in poor survival, overall survival, the OS metric, and also a shorter distance metastasis-free survival. That's known as DMFS. You don't want to have those two metrics being enhanced because of whatever is happening to the target protein you're looking at. But that's what happens when you see TIMM17A significantly elevated in breast cancer cells, okay? But not in normal tissue. Now, this goes back to this, you know, attachment-free growth too, right? So cells with spheroids are exposed to, as we've mentioned several times now, hypoxia. So what does that talk about? That says that this protease may be regulated by HIF-1 alpha. Remember, that is the transcription factor that controls the expression of polypeptides and also, to some extent, their activity upon hypoxia. So, YME1L substrates are diminished in wild-type cells which undergo hypoxia. Okay? Or after treatment with HIF-1 alpha stabilizing small molecules, which makes sense. HIF-1 alpha turns over very rapidly. But it remains elevated in YME1L knockout cells and in cell lines treated with interfering RNA for the YME protein. Okay? So now you get the entire system is, again, very linear. So depletion of HIF-1 alpha from hypoxia wild-type cells stabilizes, that means maintains, the level of the YME1L protein substrates. So putting that together, this is your synthesis. HIF-1 alpha is required to promote the proteolytic removal of those proteins. Okay, let me check my time. Yeah, 5:04 now.